I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. The greatest leader of our time has been struck down by the foulest deed of our time. Today, John Fitzgerald Kennedy lives on in the immortal words and works that he left behind. He lives on in the mind and memories of mankind. He lives on in the hearts of his countrymen. No words are sad enough to express our sense of loss. No words are strong enough to express our determination to continue the forward thrust of America that he began.
Okay, so I am here with Robert A. Caro, who is most recently the author of The Passage of Power. Bob, it's a pleasure to chat with you. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing good because I'm done with the book.
Gotcha.
And it's coming out, so it's a happy time.
Loads of questions, not much time, so let's get right down to business. So, Lyndon B. Johnson, as you have said constantly in these four volumes, was a great reader of men.
Yes.
And here was a man who even encouraged his assistants, as Horace Busby said, to look in the eyes, look at the hands.
Yes.
Here was a man who, when he had a conversation with someone, he would talk and he would talk and he would talk until he actually got exactly what it is that he wanted. And this leads me to ask you, well, what went wrong in reading John F. Kennedy? This great reader of men, were there dents in the shining armor here? What happened here?
Well, part of what happened was that, you know, it was really easy to misread Jack Kennedy when he was young because he was in constantly bad health and he had a terribly injured back. And when there were times when he couldn't do much, and part of this times was when he was in the Senate with Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson, you know, saw in Kennedy a young man who he thought wasn't willing to work.
Yeah.
Didn't know about the health. Johnson once said, you know, Kennedy, you know, he was just pathetic. He didn't even know how to address the chair, which is the worst thing you can say about a legislator. He said he was weak. He was sickly. He used to say, did you ever see his ankles? They're this big around. And
yeah.
Kennedy, of course, was at this time in very bad health. So it was one of the reasons he misread him was it was so easy to misread.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Johnson. He was slow to act in the 1960 election. You say that he might have, in fact, had the Democratic nomination if he had acted earlier. But it seems to me, in reading this, that Johnson, especially in the way that he treated Pat Brown, had this incredible self-sabotage streak, rather than the careful hand that he had mastered in the Senate, of course. So in light of the fact, though, that Johnson's 1956 attempt for the presidency didn't pan out because he was from the South, there was still, of course, Emmett Till and Arthur and Lucy going on, as you write in The Master of the Senate, why do you believe that 1960 would have been different for Johnson if he had tried earlier? I mean, he was still facing resistance from Northern liberals. There were still segregation academies being run in Virginia. So why did he have a genuine shot?
You know, in 1958,
yeah.
Lyndon Johnson is the most powerful Democrat in the country. He's the mighty majority leader of the Senate. And mighty means he's the most effective Senate majority leader in history. He has just passed in 1957, the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction.
Sure.
He's a fearsome, huge, awesome figure in Washington. And Jack Kennedy is simply a young, unknown senator. Johnson thinks he doesn't have to campaign.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks that he's going to get the nomination. He doesn't realize that there's this young senator who can speak like no one else, who can win over crowds, you know. Jack Kennedy, traveling around the country, getting support. And Kennedy is also making use of television. Johnson didn't understand the power of television. Jack Kennedy, you know, was on television at the 56th Democratic Convention a lot.
Yes.
And at one point, he meets a Johnson man in an airport someplace, and he says, Johnson man is telling him he just might as well give up. And Kennedy says, listen, do you know who the best known senator in the country is? He says, it's me, because I was on television. And he is right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you also point out that Johnson, sometime early 1960, he had his staff look into the odds of a president who was dying in office, the odds of a vice president rising to the presidency. So the mantra repeated throughout this book, power is where power goes. Sam Rayburn, a loyal ally of him in previous books, he is fiercely opposed to Johnson's vice presidential nomination. But then you have Johnson have Earl Clements basically convince Rayburn to give him the okay. So this leads me to wonder, you know, well, if Johnson even tried to make a desperate grab for this lingering power in the Senate when he became vice president, as you also point out later in the book, you know, was he truly committed to this, or was this a case comparable to what Walter Isaacson identifies as the reality distortion field in Steve Jobs? It's sort of unclear to me if he really wanted the vice presidency for the specific purposes, or whether he was just kind of waffling along, or whether he was, in fact, operating from some mode of desperation. So I was wondering if you can kind of try to answer this.
Well, a mode of desperation is a way of doing it. You know, all his life, Lyndon Johnson only wanted one thing.
Yeah.
You know, he said to his friends when he first gets to Washington, sure, as a young congressman, by God, I'll be president someday. But he realizes that no Southerner is going to get to be president. The Democratic nomination is controlled by the big northern states, the liberal northeastern states. They don't trust the Southerner. They don't trust someone from Texas. So he says, no Southerner is going to win the nomination in my lifetime. He says he thought he was going to do it. He makes this try, and he realizes he can't do it against Kennedy. So Johnson, you know, says the only route to the vice presidency, to the presidency for a Southerner,
yes,
is through the vice presidency. He didn't necessarily mean that Kennedy, you know, that president would die.
Yeah.
He meant that after the president's, if he was,
sure,
vice president, he would be the natural successor when the president finished his term. But he also, being Johnson, did exactly what you're saying. He asked his staff to look up, you know, what are the odds of a president dying in office?
Yes.
Natural causes, and he found that six of them. He used to say, six vice presidents succeeded to the presidency on the president's death. So he used to say, six of them didn't have to get elected. So that was another reason for taking the vice presidency.
Yeah, but it's interesting that there's this competing notion of, well, the odds are pretty good if I'm the vice presidency, versus this diffidence in relation to the 1960 election. And I guess I'm trying to sort of sort out why Johnson didn't make a run for what he had,
yeah,
at his hands right there.
Well, it's a good question. And I go into it at length in the book. You know, Johnson was so sure of himself in the Senate, so decisive, knew exactly what to do and was decisive. And so he wanted to act, he had the will to act, and he acted. Suddenly, when he's running for president for this thing that he wants all his life, he's very different.
Yeah.
And the people who knew him best, you know, and I talked to all of them, John Connolly, who, yeah, was his administrative assistant, George Reedy, his press secretary, Walter Jenkins, all his staff, a lot of his friends, said, you know, the one thing about Lyndon Johnson, he couldn't bear to fail. His brother, you know, his father failed, and it was a failure. They lost the farm. They really were worried that their home would be taken away from them each month. His father, because he failed, became a figure of humiliation and ridicule in his hometown. So Johnson saw what failure was, and his brother Sam Houston Johnson told me once, the most important thing for Lyndon Johnson was not to be like Daddy. And for Johnson to fail is something horrible to him. And it's like he's afraid to really try. And by the time he wakes up, and also, as I said, he thinks he's going to win without trying.
Yeah.
By the time he wakes up to the fact that Kennedy is taking it away from him and does start to try, it's too late. Kennedy has taken it away from him.
Sure. Well, there's also the whole idea of Johnson. Well, there is no Johnson who lives past 60. And yet, simultaneously, he was living this lifestyle of fluctuating weight, of constant drinking, of constant moving. He has had a heart attack before this. So, again, it's a fascinating inconsistency as to, you know, what his true goals are. And I'm wondering why, physically speaking, he couldn't stare reality in the face.
Well, Johnson, but you know, he believed, as you said, there was a saying in Johnson City, the Johnson men all die young.
Yeah.
His father died at 60 of heart failure, but he had been sick for a lot of years.
Sure.
His favorite uncle, George, died at 57 of a massive heart attack. He had another uncle who actually lived into his 70s, but he was sick with congestive heart failure for years. So Johnson was convinced that he was going to die young. And you ask, you know, why did he eat a lot? You know, actually, that's not quite the whole story. You know, before he has his heart, he has a heart attack at the age of 47. That's
yes.
a massive heart attack.
Yes.
He's only given a 50-50 chance of living. But in the ambulance, you know, he was, you know, a three-pack-a-day smoker.
Yes.
He was probably more. If you walked into his office, there were cigarettes, you know, he like burning in three or four ashtrays at once. And in the ambulance, taking him to the hospital after his heart attack, he asks the doctor if he can smoke. If he recovers, will he be able to smoke? And the doctor says no. And he says, I'd rather have my pecker cut off. However, Johnson has this real willpower. He didn't smoke again until he left the presidency.
That's right. That's
right. So he did, and he did make a real effort. Although his weight, as you say, fluctuated up and down, he did make a real effort to control it after his heart attack.
Yeah. Well, also, you challenge in this book Arthur Schlesinger's longstanding notion about the relationship between Kennedy and Johnson. Now Johnson is in the vice presidential seat. Schlesinger's idea was that, well, you know, Kennedy was absolutely fond and genial and generous. The vice president was included in most of the major meetings. And then, of course, we read this chapter, Genuine Warmth, and we find out, well, wait a minute, that's not always the case. According to Ted Sorensen as well, Johnson was shut out from a pivotal XCOM decision relating to the decision meeting relating to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, and that also is in large part because he's a bit hawkish, to say the least. So my question is why has the lens of history been so keen to favor the Schlesinger viewpoint? And what was the first key fact that you uncovered that made you say to yourself, well, this isn't exactly true? What caused you to sort of start prying further and further that things were not all, you know, wine and roses?
Well, you know, part of it was when you, as soon as you start to look at Johnson and the Kennedys, you hear about the nickname that the Kennedy people called him, Rufus Cornpone.
That's right.
Uncle Cornpone, Uncle Rufus. You know, they coined, for Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird, they used to call him Uncle Rufus and his little, Uncle Cornpone and his little pork chop. So you say, you know, then you ask someone like Ted Sorensen, who helped me immensely on this book. He was the person probably closest to Kennedy in the administration.
You spent a lot of time with him.
I spent a lot of time with Ted. And, you know, he said, yes, as has previously been said, Johnson was included at all the big meetings, the cabinet meetings, the National Security Council. But in the Kennedy government, those weren't the meetings that mattered. The meetings that mattered were the small little groups that Kennedy would convene. And Johnson wasn't invited to those. You know, when the 1963 Civil Rights Act is introduced by the Kennedys, and Johnson has to say to Ted Sorensen, and we have a recording of it, you know, I don't know what's in this act. I have to read about it in the New York Times. The greatest legislator of our time, possibly of the century, the greatest legislator of the 20th century is not consulted on Kennedy's legislation.
Yeah. Why then has the Schlesinger lens been allowed to proliferate for so long? That's the real question.
Well, I don't know that it's just the Schlesinger lens.
Yeah.
I really can't answer you that question. But when you talk to the surviving Kennedy people, like Sorensen, when you read their oral histories, you see it's simply not true. I mean, there's, you know, Horace Busby talks, you know, basically about going to see Sorensen one day and asking, well, what role do you want Lyndon Johnson to play in this administration? And Sorensen says, salesman for the administration. I mean, this is Lyndon Johnson. He's going to be a salesman for the administration. Johnson says to an aide, Harry McPherson, you know, they've turned the legislative duties over to Larry O'Brien. Johnson says, you know, O'Brien hasn't been to see me to ask advice once in 2 years. So you really, it's undeniable that Johnson was shut out from Kennedy's legislative processes and from the key meeting on the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
He's not invited to it.
I know. It's really amazing. One of the other great showdowns in this book, the great clashes, is between Bobby Kennedy and Johnson. I mean, you know, you want to talk about cats and dogs. These two guys were it. You have their first meeting in the Senate cafeteria in 1953, where Kennedy was glowering at Johnson and forced to shake his hand. Then, years later, Johnson is vice president, and he's largely powerless, as we've been establishing here. He serves on the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity, and Bobby Kennedy shows up late, humiliates him over two meetings.
Yeah.
And then on the Saturday after the Kennedy assassination, there's this misunderstanding over whether, you know, over how the West Wing is going to be cleared out, ready for Johnson. There's this very tense meeting not long after, but Johnson is in this interesting predicament of having to maintain the Kennedy faction all through Election Day in 1964. Yet he also tests the waters a bit with the Thomas Mann nomination. So my question is, was there any hope of Bobby Kennedy and Johnson putting aside their differences? What factors do you think caused Bobby to acquiesce to Johnson for the good of the nation while he was president, while Johnson was president?
Well, he doesn't always acquiesce. You know,
sure,
we see him breaking with Johnson breaking with him strongly over Vietnam in 1967 and 1968 and running for the nomination. You know,
yeah.
I mean, when Bobby Kennedy enters the race, you know, Lyndon Johnson bows out, basically. So they don't, but you say, you know, when you try, you know, people don't understand, in my opinion, enough. And I try to explain in my books how personality, how character has so much to do with politics and government. And with Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, whatever the reasons are, at bottom you have this personal hostility. You talked about the first meeting. You know, this first meeting is when Lyndon Johnson is the leader. He is the mighty leader. Bobby Kennedy has, I think he's 27.
Yeah.
And he's just gone to work for Senator Joe McCarthy as a staffer. So Joe McCarthy has this, sits every, the Senate cafeteria is on the second floor of the Senate office building. And every morning Johnson goes in there to have breakfast with his aides. And Joe McCarthy is sitting at every morning at this big round table near the cashier with four or five or six of his aides, you know. And every time Johnson comes in, McCarthy jumps up, as everyone does, to Johnson and says, hello, Mr. Leader, can I have a few minutes of your time, Mr. Leader? Good work yesterday, Mr. Leader, you know. One morning, there's a new staffer there. It's Robert Kennedy. Johnson walks over, Senator McCarthy jumps up, and so, as always, do all his staffers, except one. Robert Kennedy, this 27-year-old staffer, sits there glaring at Johnson. Johnson knows how to handle situations like this. You know, he holds out his hand to everybody sort of halfway out and sort of forces Bobby Kennedy to stand up and take his hand. And George Reedy said to me, I said, what was behind that? George Reedy said, you know, you ever see two dogs come into a room that never met each other and the hair rises on the back of their neck immediately and there's a low growl? He said that was the relationship between Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Of course, there were other reasons. Robert Kennedy was very attached and devoted to his father, Joseph P. Kennedy.
Sure.
And Johnson, when he was running for the, even before, I'm sorry, to go back, Johnson had, who was close to Roosevelt, was always repeating these stories about Roosevelt's firing Joe Kennedy, tricking him into coming back to Washington from England and then firing him, making him look bad. So I think that Robert Kennedy hated him for that. But it's not too strong a word to use hatred for what was going on between Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And, you know, at the convention, one of Johnson's assistants, Bobby Baker, he thinks everything's just politics. So he's having breakfast in a coffee shop in Los Angeles at the convention. He sees Bobby Kennedy comes in, and he says, how about sitting down? He's Bobby Baker's with his wife, having breakfast, but Bobby Kennedy sits down. But within 2 minutes, he's up, and he throws money on the table. And he says to Baker, don't worry, you'll get yours when the time comes. Well, the time came when Johnson was Jack Kennedy's vice president. Bobby Kennedy has, in effect, power over him. And he makes life miserable for Lyndon Johnson.
What you said at the beginning of this about character being a defining quality of politics, I mean, Johnson, as you establish in this book and in Master of the Senate, is a master vote counter. He has his tally sheets when he's in the Senate. He's going ahead and making sure he knows exactly how things line up. In this book, you point out during the wheat bill that not only does he want enough votes to make the wheat bill die, he also actually needs to, he wants it murdered, as he says.
Yeah.
So the question I have is, well, he may have been a master vote counter, but how much character did he need to go along with that? Was vote counting enough for him? Was that relentless drive just as much of a quality as the sheer statistician approach that he had?
Well, it was never a sheer statistician quote.
I mean, of course.
Was a great legislator. Listen, a key thing in politics, you know, is the ability to count.
Yeah.
You know, and Johnson was the great counter. He used to, you know, he'd send aides out to find how senators were going to vote. Sometimes someone would come back, but they usually didn't do this more than once, and said, I think Senator X is going to vote this way. And Johnson would say, what good is thinking to me? I need to know.
Yeah.
You know, he never wanted to lose a vote. So vote counting, he was the great vote counter. Do you know, when he's a young congressman, he comes to Washington, he's 29 years old. He falls in with this group of New Dealers who later become famous, like Abe Fortas, Jim Rowe, Tommy the Cork Corcoran. These are guys who live and breathe politics. But they say, and you know what they do for when they have a dinner party Saturday night, they get together for dinner? They count votes. They say, how is Roosevelt's bill on this going to pass? And Johnson, they said, was always right.
Yeah.
Johnson, we might think so. This senator was going to vote this way. Johnson always knew he was the greatest vote counter. And when he was in the Senate, he was the greatest vote counter of them all. But that's not all of why Johnson was great. Johnson was this master on the Senate floor. You know, when they're having amendments and there's debates and there's shouting back and forth, he can seize the moment. He sees the moment where he can win, you know. And he acts decisively. He says, call the vote. And he's majority leader, you know. And he would stand there at the majority leader's desk. So he's towering over everybody else, his front row center desk. He's got this big arm in the air. And if he's got the votes and he wants the vote fast before anyone can change, or maybe some people on the other side who are absent aren't there, he makes little circles in his hands like someone revving up an airplane to get the clerk to call the rolls faster. And if one of his votes wasn't there and he was being rushed from somewhere in a car across Washington, he would make a stretching motion with his hands. He ran this. There were a lot of things that went into Johnson's dominance of the Senate.
Yeah. Let's talk about Richard Russell.
Okay.
Richard Russell actually gets played big time in this book. He's, of course, the Georgian politician who was viewed with integrity, but also was against all these civil rights efforts throughout his career. You point out to this really interesting incident during the Warren Commission where Johnson calls him up. He reads all the names on the list except for Warren, which he conceals from him. Then he appoints Russell to the Warren Commission without giving him the option. He basically issues the press release with his name on it. He says, you know, this isn't for me. This is for the country. So this is the same guy who anointed Johnson as his successor. This is the same guy who wanted to see Johnson president a few years before, who projected his own failures during the 1952 convention. So why was Russell so easily manipulated by Johnson like this? What, did he see any of this coming, or was it just simply a matter of Johnson taking advantage of his particular position as president?
Well, he wasn't easily manipulated by Johnson. Russell wasn't easily manipulated by anybody.
Yeah.
But Johnson has this gift of ingratiating himself with older men.
Yeah.
And seeing what's the key thing now that will enable him to do that. So with Russell, what's the key thing that he's lonely? Richard Russell is a bachelor. He's the most powerful senator when Johnson gets there. He leads the Southern Caucus, which controls Congress. But Johnson, so when Johnson comes to the Senate, the first thing he has to do is get close to Russell. So he doesn't ask for a place on the most better committees. Russell is the chairman of Armed Services, which is not one of the four or five best committees. He asks Bobby Baker, who's been in the Senate, where is the power in the Senate? And Bobby Baker basically says to him, there's only one power in the Senate, it's Richard Russell. So Johnson knows he has to get close to Russell. So he doesn't ask for a seat on a more powerful committee. He asks for a seat on Russell's committee. And he starts to work. Now, Russell worked in the evenings. He worked Saturdays. He worked Sundays because he had no other life. He was a bachelor. Johnson works the same thing. So he's thrown together with Russell. He starts to say to Russell, come home for dinner, you know. Russell doesn't do that kind of thing,
yeah.
You know. But Johnson is, you know, Johnson says, you got to eat somewhere, Dick. It's 10 o'clock. So Russell starts to more and more to come to the Johnson home. He loves the Johnson daughters. Lady Bird is a Southern lady, and she makes him feel at home. And then the key thing is Johnson convinces Richard Russell that he believes the same way Russell does on civil rights, that he, in fact, wants black people kept in their place. It's not true, but he convinces him that it's true. I once asked Herman Talmadge, who was one of Russell's, he was a great senator from Georgia also, and I said, did you think Lyndon Johnson was going to be with you when he became president? And Talmadge says, yes. And I said, well, what would Johnson say to you? I said, what was his view of blacks and whites as far as you understood it? And
yeah.
He said, master and slave, you know?
Yeah.
But as soon as Johnson becomes president, the awakening comes. Because in the first speech after Kennedy's assassination, he says the exact quotes in the passage to power, I can't remember it right now, but he says, the most important thing we can do to honor Jack Kennedy's legacy is to pass his civil rights bill.
Yes.
And the Southern senators are all sitting there in a row, believe, what did Russell feel? Because Russell was the man who raised him to power when he realizes that Johnson is now going to be, and Russell knows, you know, he says, we could have beaten Jack Kennedy on civil rights. He says, but we're not going to be able to beat Lyndon. And Orville Freeman says, why not? He says, Johnson knows how to use power. He says, he'll tear off your arm and beat you over the head with it. He'll do whatever he has to do to win. We're not going to be able to beat Lyndon.
But after this whole scenario with the Warren Commission, how does Russell feel? I mean, Russell, I guess we'll have to wait for Volume 5. This might be a Volume 5 question. But I mean, just to sort of ask you, I mean, were things even close to the same thing after the whole Warren Commission betrayal? Or?
Well, it's not a Warren Commission betrayal, exactly. It's a Warren Commission Johnson tricking Russell into being, but you
subterfuge.
Know. But he does it in such a way. If you listen to I was listening to the tape of Johnson's conversation. He's really saying to him, I need you. The country needs you. We need you because you are the most respected senator. You know, we need you on this commission. It's not a phone call that ends in hostility.
Yeah.
It's a phone call with Johnson getting what he wanted from Russell because he tricked him. But actually, at the end of it, there's a paternal note. You know, Johnson says, you know, I mean, he uses whatever. He says, you know, Dick, you've been my daddy. He says, you've been a daddy to me. And Russell is not quite moved, you know.
Yeah.
And Johnson, so he goes to the mother. He says, no one ever taught me more about life than you except my mother. So he uses this paternal card. And at the end of the call, while Russell was angry at the beginning, you hear Johnson has brought him around. And during and in the passage of power, we really see that the relationship is going to go on. Even though Johnson is going to beat him on civil rights, he's still going to stay friends with Russell.
Yeah. So Johnson could play Russell we could call.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That he could play him exclusively by this emotional card, by preying upon his loneliness, by preying upon this whole paternal scenario.
You know, Johnson would always see a weakness in somebody. You know, he wasn't a man who played to a man's strengths, but he could see a weakness. And Russell had a weakness, and he had a weak point. He didn't have the weakness was, and you can understand it. I mean, you say, this is a man who on weekends, he goes down to in the Senate, he's this mighty figure, but on the weekends, the Senate isn't in session. So when he's not working alone in his office on a weekend, he's back in his room. He's a voracious reader, Russell. He reads all Gibbon, he reads everything on Rome, but you can't read all the time, and he's lonely. And there is a loneliness. And Johnson, you know, I don't use things like in the passage of power, I don't say things like father-son relationship.
Yeah.
I think that's an oversimplification. Johnson once said to Doris Kearns, you know, something about, the quote is in the passage of power, the exact quote, older men have a sense when their powers are deteriorating. He says they get a little worried. And when someone offers to help and offers to and more takes their advice, because they have so much advice to give, if only someone would listen to them, it's like they're finding a well in the desert. And Johnson, with older men, he took their advice. I mean, he names one older senator, Mr. Wisdom. He's writing, I need a little of your wisdom. How's Mr. Wisdom today? He was great with older men, and he was unbelievable with older men. And in the passage of power, we see him getting Kennedy's tax bill started just by working on this. Like, Kennedy has introduced his tax cut bill. It's vital for the country. It is absolutely vital. So he introduces it in January, and it goes to Harry Byrd. Harry Byrd is this elderly senator from Virginia, but this absolute power. And he is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and the bill is sent to the Senate Finance Committee in January, and now it's November, and the bill is still in the Senate Finance Committee, and it's dithering along, and nothing's happening. And Kennedy is assassinated, and the Kennedy people keep talking about, we'll go around Harry Byrd, we'll go around Harry Byrd. I think you've read this in the passage of power. So two or three nights, it's either the night of Kennedy's funeral or the night before, I forget. Johnson calls in Kennedy's three top economic advisors, Walter Heller, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Kermit Gordon, the Budget Bureau director, and Gardner Ackley. And they start talking to him about going around Harry Byrd. And Lyndon Johnson says, you can't go around Harry Byrd. And they say, why not? He says, because there's 17 votes on the Finance Committee and Harry Byrd has 9. They say, how do you know he has 9? He says, because Harry Byrd always has 9. And all of a sudden, we know this because two of them came out and dictated memos on what happened in the meeting, so they both agree that this is, all of a sudden, they say, this year-long problem disappears. Johnson says, so you give Harry Byrd what he wants and we can have the rest of the tax cut and budget bill. And all of a sudden, the problem is over and the tax cut bill starts to move. Part of Johnson's genius is him knowing how to deal with human beings. And it's part of this thing that I'm glad you picked out, that I hope the passage of power makes clear, that character issues, personality things, little things, have such an impact on governments and huge policies. And I think we see it in this book with Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and Jack Kennedy. It's like this book is about all three of them, you know? And personality is a big part of it.
In light of the fact that Lyndon preyed on, I keep using the word pray for some reason, I don't know why, something about your books. He went ahead and he used older men, Sam Rayburn and Richard Russell, but then there's this really harrowing, terrible treatment of Pierre Salinger in this book, Johnson's press secretary. The Christmas Ranch episode where Salinger, this portly man, has to wear a windbreaker and get on a horse while the press is there. Another instance, Salinger is this guy, he's writing piano ditties, very witty little ditties, and he has him go on right after Van Cleburne. And I'm reading this, and I say to myself, how can a man who only a few years before was dissed at every turn, and I actually felt a little sorry for him during his vice presidential days, how could he, once he has the power yet again, why is he so mean? Why is he so bullying here? Especially for a guy like Salinger, who was really helping him out.
Johnson, you know, he had to be ingratiating to people above him.
Yeah.
And he had to be domineering. People, to be his subordinate was to be constantly abused verbally and symbolically. And what he does to Salinger, you know, Salinger makes the mistake of making Johnson think he's, you know, that he will accept his leadership like Kennedy. So Johnson humiliates him in the way, I mean, the episode with the horse down on the ranch. I mean, Salinger's a portly man, not used to riding horses. After one press conference, Johnson jumps up on a horse. He's a great horseman, big black horse. And he's got a little horse there. And he insists that Salinger get up on it. Salinger is terribly uncomfortable. A million cameras are clicking away, capturing this moment, you know. And Johnson trots away with Salinger on this little horse after him. It's hard, you know, throughout all four of my books about Johnson, one of the most just hard to write about is the way he treats subordinates, the way he humiliates them and ridicules men who are loyal to him.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think that is? Was it a case of Johnson not trusting someone unless he got pushback from one of his subordinates, unless he was constantly questioned, unless it was a challenge for him? Or was he just a petty bully?
Well, with his subordinates, he was a bully.
Yeah.
And there's nothing nice about it. You know, what's dramatic in this book, in The Passage of Power, is that he keeps this tendency under control, because for a period after Kennedy's assassination, he must keep the Kennedy people with him. They're not going to stand for this. Salinger quits.
Yeah.
Okay. They're not. If he Johnson acts the way he's going to act, the way he has acted all his life, you know, they're not going to stay with him. So he puts an iron control on himself. And someone says, you know, it's like before he had an alarm clock that told him every 2 hours to blow his fuse at somebody. But for 7 or 8 weeks after this assassination, in what I call the passage of power, there are no explosions.
Yeah.
I mean,
people say he's a different man.
He's a different man.
Yeah.
And I write the last lines of the book are that he had kept this trait and other traits under control. He wouldn't be able to do it for long, but the last line of the book is, but he had done it long enough. He took the nation through this crisis, the crisis of Jack Kennedy's assassination, and when he had to be at his best, when he had to discipline himself, when he does everything he had to do, in what I say is a triumph not only of genius, but of willpower.
Let's talk about Bobby Baker. Shortly before November 22nd,
yes,
Johnson's bagman, Bobby Baker, he's exposed for his financial shenanigans, identified in the press as Johnson's protege. Baker, he's actually testifying before Senate investigators on November 22nd. You have Life magazine about to run this huge hit piece on Johnson's net worth, but then the Kennedy assassination, of course, puts an end to that. Life eventually is going to run this piece in August of 1964, and I realize we're probably getting into Volume 5 territory, but what's fascinating here is the sensitivity with which Life actually handled this matter. I mean, this is unthinkable in today's media climate.
I would say so.
You know, why did the Senate investigators and the journalists wait so long to expose Johnson? Why was there this great deference back then?
You know, it was you said it. It was a different world. Can you imagine? Life magazine has discovered, basically, that Lyndon Johnson, who was, had no job other than being on a government payroll all his life, was a millionaire many times over, and that he had become this in large part because of radio and television interests that were government controlled, the FCC controlled. They have already run one story on this, and they have assigned 9 reporters to be an investigative team to look into the rest. But one guy says it was going to be a series on basically, quote, Lyndon Johnson's money. The very morning that Jack Kennedy is driving through Dallas and Lyndon Johnson is behind him in his car, as that is going on, the 9-member Life team is meeting with the Life managing editor and executive editor in the executive editor's offices in New York to divide up the areas of investigation into Lyndon Johnson's money. And the question is, we've got enough to run an article in this very next issue. This is the issue that's going to press, like, tonight, yeah. You know? When someone, a secretary runs in, and it, first the first word is, the president's been shot, not that he's killed. He's
yeah.
Shot. So the thing breaks up instantly. The reporters run back, and the editors know they can't run the article in this issue because there's not going to be time. There's going to be not going to be space. There's going to the whole magazine is going to be taken up with the assassination. A few days later, the leader of the team, a man named William Lambert, the leader of the investigative team, goes in to see Ralph Graves, the executive editor, and says to Graves, you know, he's president now. We ought to give him a chance. And Graves says to Lambert, if you hadn't said that, I was going to tell you so. And in fact, it is dropped, you know. The other part of what you say, which is the most unbelievable to me, Johnson has not been tied directly to this Bobby Baker scandal.
Yeah.
As that motorcade is going through Dallas, at the very same moment, he is being tied to it because a witness named Don B. Reynolds, an insurance broker, is in the Senate office building with his lawyer beside him, testifying before Senate investigators and producing documents which tie Lyndon Johnson to the Bobby Baker case. They don't even know the assassination has occurred. Because no one has remembered that they are in this little room doing this. About 2:30 or 1:30 Texas, about an hour and a half after Kennedy's, a secretary bursts in and says the president's been dead,
yeah.
and that is stopped for a while. It's, you know, Johnson's career. You know, there was no lower moment in his career than the moments before Jack Kennedy's assassination. He's looking at a future. He's beginning to doubt that he will be even picked on the ticket in 64. That may or may not be true. We don't know, because we don't know what's in Jack Kennedy's mind, but it's there's certainly beginning to be a likelihood of that. And then this gunshot crack, and I mean, at this moment, Bobby Kennedy is over him, humiliating him. He's being ignored by Jack Kennedy, the president. He has no role, really, in the administration. There is a gunshot. And in that instant of the gunshot, the world is turned upside down, and he is president of the United States. And writing this book, The Passage of Power, I had to try to say to myself, you have to make the reader see what was happening, feel what was happening to Lyndon Johnson in these moments when he's rushed to the hospital. You know, no one, I mean, really, very little has been known about what happened with Lyndon Johnson's point of view in the assassination. So I got these Secret Service, the reports of the Secret Service men. You know, and you hear about how the instant of the gunshot, the Secret Service men in the front seat of Johnson's convertible whirls around, grabs Johnson's shoulder, throws him on the floor of the back seat, and jumps over jumps over the back of the front seat and lies on Johnson as they to protect him, to shield him with his own body as they roar to Parkland Hospital. Then Johnson is rushed into this little cubicle and he stands there for about 40 minutes. He doesn't even know what's happened. He's not being told, given a definitive word on Kennedy's condition. Lady Bird says then, about 40 minutes later, Kenny O'Donnell, one of Kennedy's aides and friends walks in, and Lady Bird says, wrote in her diary, seeing the stricken face of Kenny O'Donnell, who loved him, we knew.
Yeah.
And a moment later, another Kennedy aide comes in and says to Johnson, Mr. President. It was the first time he had been called president. So you have to try to show, I mean, I don't say I succeeded, but I tried to show in the passage of power this incredible moment in history where Johnson is catapulted from one of the lowest moments of his lowest times of his life to the power he has wanted all his life and what he does with it.
To close this conversation, one quick inquiry. That's okay. Tom Wicker, who you quote at the end of the book, he has said that Johnson's legacy will be known more for his lowering of the presidency than for the Great Society. We were talking earlier about the Schlesinger prism and how you uncovered facts that worked in opposition to that. I'm wondering if on volume 5, whether this is a similar conflict that's going on right now in relation to the Wicker idea. It's generally agreed upon that he lowered the presidency, that, you know, Vietnam and so forth. And this, of course, overshadowed the Great Society. Do you feel a journalistic or historical responsibility to work in contra to this particular...
No, not, I certainly don't feel responsible to work in contra.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If you're doing something and you find that it's correct, which is certainly what you often find out, then you do that. I will say that that is the great, without saying that I come to the same conclusion as Wicker, that is going to be the great story of the next book, how Johnson sets out to transform a country. If the Great Society and war and poverty had gone the way he wanted, we speak of transformational presidents. This was a president who was out to transform America. And then you see the Vietnam War just burying this. I'm going to try to show that in the last volume.